You can lose, but I know how you love to win. Break my damn down and pick me like a javelin. Whoa, you said we can't all be dumb. Bad news keeps.
Have we started the show?
Welcome back to Rock Under Fire.
What's and what we are calling
part two of the disco years.
What episode are we on?
This goes down as episode 28.
795.
28.
We all got our flared bell-bottom pants on and our button-down shirts, big lapel collars wide down to our chest with our gold cross showing out. Mikey D and Stick got their platform shoes on.
I literally do have them. So why are we talking about disco?
Wearing
and
Chaps
this?
Cologne.
Chaps.
Yeah.
Sassoon jeans.
I forgot about designer Brute
by Fabergé.
Jeans. That's what we should have talked about, the designer jeans when we had those two chicks over, man.
Oh, yeah, because they used to rock the Jordache jeans back
in 63
and Sassoon.
Hey, you twos.
Hey, you twos.
Not a year or two. You guys remember when all the girls were wearing Jordache and Sassoon and looking very, very good.
Brooke Shields,
79,
right? She was like
80.
A sponsor. Brooke Shields was
I think you're
Brooke
right.
Brooke Shields.
Yeah, perfect.
It's good to have the three of us back again, all three of us in the same room.
This has been it's been like 2 months because we've had a guest, somebody sitting at this table for the past 2 months. So this is, I think, is the first time in like, what, four or five shows since
you keep track
just
of that stuff
of
in your head, man.
I don't know.
It goes beyond
it's
me.
Just, it's just something I noticed. That
things have been weird lately, yeah.
How's everybody's summer going?
It's been a crazy summer with the show because everybody's sitting around this table.
The only constant
somehow,
is you, Mike.
Some way.
It's your baby, bro. We're your babies.
You are our constant.
You feed us. Keep spoon feeding us to Gerber. We'll chill. So,
it's late July now. Last time we met was.
As a trio
was like what? April, early May?
May, I think it was sometime.
After Bob Gruen.
Yeah, yep.
Yeah, it feels like it. I haven't seen you guys in a while, man. So,
well, you were here for Mr. Dr.
Marlowe.
Dr. Marlowe.
That's my last show. Dr. Marlowe was my last show.
Yeah.
About a month ago now.
Good.
Had a nice refreshing break. Yeah. I feel fresh and ready to go.
How's everybody out in Wisconsin doing?
I paid everybody a visit, you know, gave them a piece of my mind.
Tonight my name is Anderson, because I got the Anderson Coke bottle.
So.
I posted on Facebook, I had the Coke bottle that said Johnson. Who is your child, Johnson? Johnson, get your ass over here.
Oh, you know they're going to last name. I didn't realize the Coke's going to last
names. Right?
I was in Wildwood last week, my name was Foster.
I posted a picture on Facebook, me and my Johnson.
I milked this Coke bottle for 2 days, it was called Foster.
Foster.
Yeah,
yep,
so I was
last
Foster
names.
Last week.
Probably not going to see any of our names, though.
I'm Foster Anderson.
You see Ivan Itsky on a bottle, I'm going to lose my shit.
Yeah, you'll lose your shit.
That's my name tonight, Foster Anderson.
Foster Anderson. Right, Foster. He was a comedian from like the 60s.
Was he?
I think he was. Foster something was a comedian.
Foster Brooks?
Foster Brooks, I'm thinking. Yes, thank you, Mike. He always played the drunk on like the Dean Martin show.
He used to do the roast.
Yeah.
Oh, man, I'm not picturing Foster Brooks. I'm really not.
He had a beard. He kind of looked like a...
You
like,
got to know him.
Like he was homeless, man. Captain he looked like one of those guys you find in the stalls at Penn Station.
I'm picturing a face.
He always made Dean Martin laugh his ass off.
Yeah. Oh, shit.
I just went into a big study of the Rat Pack, speaking of Dean Martin. All my prep for this, the disco thing, man, in the last month or two has been a lot of disco reading. And so I've had this book on Frank Sinatra sitting next to my bed for the past 2 months.
Let me stop. I've seen that book.
For the right
time. It's a gigantic tome. Are you reading this thing from cover to cover? Is that your intention?
Well, yeah.
Are you?
Yeah.
How does that tie into disco, though?
I know you...
Well, because I finally got around to it.
Oh, I see. Okay.
I finally got around to after like all this prep for the disco thing, and I had an interview last week, a couple weeks ago, and now it's just kind of like exhaling, you know, just like finally. And I was down the shore last week, and I brought my big fat Frank Sinatra book, and it just so happens that... There, you know, those publications like the National Geographic and Life magazine and what else? They put those like those big $12 magazines on one subject.
Yeah.
There's a Life
Time
magazine.
Time Life does that a lot.
Yeah.
And
the current
I like those.
One is the Rat Pack.
Yeah.
So I bought one of those and just took it to my room.
Those are great. Little books in magazine form. Get all kinds of
that's
news.
That's my what's going on.
That's your what's going on? You've been reading
the
Sinatra book?
That's my what's going on. I have nothing else.
I saw
you. You know what? Now, I know you have a habit when you read biographies of skipping the early years. I've heard you say, I don't really give a shit what went on with Keith Richards when he was 8 or 10. Is that
You know what? Frank Sinatra's mom ties very heavily into his personality and why he became the way he did.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and it kind of starts, like, there's no, like, a steady climb to, you know, where it's just like, okay, let's get through this boring shit.
Right.
Like a lot of biographies do. This one starts off, you know, you hit the ground running, so to speak, you know, and it's right. Just kind of gets right into all the mob stuff right away.
It's not chronological, man. Yeah.
It is chronological, yeah.
Mob
but,
stuff is what I would want to read that.
Yeah.
Hey, man, we got to start talking more about books, you know. I know for my part, ever since we started this freaking endeavor, I spent a lot more time reading rock and roll books. Well, I got these twin obsessions, right? I'm obsessed with rock music and nature. I've been reading a lot less nature books since we started this affair. You know, so we're all readers, you know.
Yeah,
we don't talk enough about the books that we're reading, particularly rock books, man. We really need a new segment, the Book Report.
The Book Report.
Yeah.
You know? Very interesting.
Yeah. We just need like an opening jingle. You know, like, ha-ba-ba. My book report.
Did you get your book report in?
That's good.
Mrs. McGillicuddy.
Sounds like you're a wise ass. You're a wise ass song. You're a wise ass.
The book report.
I saw a good cover band last week. Eagle Mania. It was an all Eagles cover band. They were really good, man. You got to be an Eagles fan to go see something like that. But it was a free concert in Woodbridge Township here in New Jersey, and I had nothing going on. My mother was away. My daughter's away in Illinois. I was like, you know what? The hell with this. I'm going to go check it out. I brought a lawn chair. Ran
spontaneously?
Into
some,
yeah.
Look at you.
I'm never spontaneous. Ran into some folks that I knew.
Sign of youth, man.
Had some beers, just chilled out underneath the stars and listened to some Eagles.
Where?
Woodbridge you texted me about that, and I was almost kind of wishing I was there, because I was by myself. I was sitting in the freaking hotel room. I was sitting outside. I remember I was sitting outside by the pool, and it was like, you're like, what are you doing tonight? I'm like, I'm a Wildwood man, you know.
So, I knew you were going. I didn't know if you were going to be down there that early.
Well, this dude didn't show up yet. He didn't show up for a couple of days, and my brother was somewhere, and I go down there with my brother and my nephew, and I was just like sitting there by myself, and I was just kind of like, you know, what do I do? And he texted me about this Eagles tribute band.
Yeah.
I was like, shit, I'd probably be better off just doing that.
Yeah.
They were good, man. They were really good.
But you didn't go, bro?
No,
I was 2 hours away.
Okay.
I wish that my mother didn't go to New York State, because if she was around to feed the dogs and hang out with the dogs, I would have taken off and went to Wildwood for 2 days.
I was thinking about the Eagles when I was down in Wildwood, too, for some reason. I have no idea why. But they were in my mind.
They got a big show coming up this weekend.
You're talking about the cover band.
No, the regular Eagles. Eagles, Steely Dan, Doobie Brothers on Saturday at City
Field. Are you gone?
No, Classic East. I had a line on tickets, though. They were relatively close up front for like $240 a piece, but I declined.
Little steep for your blood or what?
Yeah. Steely Dan, I can see at PNC or Beacon, which I would prefer to Beacon anyway.
Hell yeah.
I thought about doing the Foreigner Cheap Trick show Saturday, but it was raining, and then I realized that, you know what, I love Cheap Trick. Not a big fan of Foreigner. You know, I like their early hits from the first three albums. Mm-hmm. Anything after Head Games, they could keep. But
bam,
I would
take
just
that.
Rather see
Foreigner.
They were good, man. I saw
Cheap
them.
Trick as a headliner. I don't want to see Cheap Trick as an opening act.
Mike, you and I know each other well. You know, I agree 100%. Cheap Trick all the way.
Who they open for? Foreigner opened for Kid Rock 1 year. They were really good. What do you call it?
Lou Gramm, how's he holding up? Is that the singer?
Well, Lou Gramm is no longer in it.
Oh,
he's not with them. He hasn't been with them for years. Right. Eddie was sick, but he was on Eddie Trunk.
Kelly something.
They got a...
And it's the 40th anniversary. He was at the whole original lineup was at Jones Beach like two or three nights before, and he's sporadically showing up and playing with them and doing like the encores and stuff like that.
Mick Jones, you mean, right?
Mick Jones is like
Because Lou Gramm has like it's like a situation like Dennis DeYoung with Styx, like he's like persona non grata.
No, he's showing
Dennis
up.
Dennis DeYoung?
No,
not Dennis DeYoung. DeYoung. Lou Gramm.
Lou Gramm, yeah. He had a throat surgery of some sort.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and he showed up.
I thought it was basically just Mick Jones.
Now it is, yes. But Lou Graham showed up at Jones Beach, and he's sporadically showing up at different shows and doing the encore.
My bad.
Yeah.
I thought it was like something like that was presently happening.
No. He's not touring with him.
Yeah.
You know what? I've talked about this on the show before. Last year at the Joan Jett concert, stuck in traffic, missed Cheap Trick. Still have not seen Cheap Trick my entire life, even though they are a favorite. And as I indicated to you the other day, man, I'm driving down the Wildwood in the car, and a new Cheap Trick song comes on. I don't know, man. It didn't sound like Robin Zander to me, man. I don't know. You know, it sounded like if I played it for you, I would love to just play it for you and say, who is this? What band do you think this is? I want to see if you can nail it. Because Robin Zander, to me, I ain't saying he sounded bad, but whoever this singer was didn't sound like Robin.
Yeah.
In my estimation. I don't know. I don't know what to make of it.
They were on Live at Daryl's House, that Daryl Hall show.
Yeah.
And I didn't think they sounded great at all. I mean, I don't know if it's age catching up with them or, you know, I don't know. It was Robin definitely didn't sound like Robin. I'm not a huge Cheap Trick guy by any stretch of the imagination. But I know their hits and stuff like that. He just didn't sound he didn't sound himself.
He's got the type of voice where I'd be impressed if he aged well, man. Like, I don't know.
The Cheap Trick is weird with me. It's kind of like they're unique in that there's no other band or artist out there that has the situation with me that Cheap Trick does.
True.
And that's that most of their music from 1981 on.
You don't even care for
shit about it. I don't care about it. You know? I recognize them as a great band. I've seen them live. They're great live.
Not rocking out the flame.
The first...
Right. Stuff like The Flame.
The first 3.5 albums are like among my favorite albums ever.
Me too.
It's like it's like candy. It's just total pure ear candy. Mm. And
it really is.
I'll
melts
never get sick of the first Cheap Trick album, In Color, Heaven Tonight, and Half a Dream Police, because I think on the Half a Dream Police, they kind of became what they would like, you know, their later sound. They kind of started losing it halfway. Like, once they did that song Voices, it's like, okay, this kind of becomes the template for the flame.
Yeah.
A lot of people like Cheap Trick in the 80s. They put some catchy things out in the early
later
MTV
work, bro.
Years, you know, but
were,
I'm sure they are. Didn't
the 80s
click
were
with
a weird
me.
Era for a lot of bands.
Yeah, they got caught up in it too.
Everybody got caught up in it. You had to write a hit.
Yeah.
You had to, you know, and our subject tonight, some bands did the same thing in the 70s with the disco thing. They were like, okay, this is what's playing on radio.
Oh, we're going to get
is
into
hot.
That.
Let's write something that's going to get on radio.
We're going to get into that.
You know, in the 80s was the same way. Everybody was rocking out fucking ballads with, you know, permed hair and fucking, you know, a sailor cap of some sort.
And the last time I saw them was like the very end of the 90s when they went back and started doing their albums beginning to end, where they did I saw them like two or three nights in a row. I saw two nights in a row because we were playing a show the third night, so otherwise I would have gone. So I saw them do In Color in its entirety. Mm-hmm. I saw them do Heaven Tonight in its entirety. And then the following summer in Central Park, I saw them do At Budokan in its entirety.
Now, aren't they one of the bands that do like a Beatles record too? Did they do?
I think they did Sergeant.
Was it Sergeant Pepper or Abbey Road or White Album or something like that?
I think Sergeant Pepper, but don't quote me on it.
Yeah, but they are one of those bands that's done it. I know Fish has done it as well.
The Beatles influence is undeniable in Cheap Trick. Listen to like a song called "So Good to See You," off of
Color, the harmonies, man,
are downed. Yeah, man.
I'll good never stuff. Forget the night. It had to be 12 or 14 years ago now. I picked up In Color in Black and White, mint copy of it for $2.99, used vinyl. I texted you, hey, man, because you know your shit about Cheap Trick. I didn't. How's this record, In Color in Black and White? You text me back, dude, one of their best, one of their two best. I was like, fuck yeah. Put it on that night. Instant love. Instant. Took right to it. Love at first touch.
And it's like choosing between, I mean, I don't have any kids, but if I had kids, it'd be like trying to choose between your kids, like In Color, Heaven Tonight, which is the best.
It's one
album.
Of those situations.
It really is. And it depends on the day and
an
argument can be made. It's like, I don't know. That's how, but that's how I am with the first
today.
Two
I'm going to go with that one.
Cars album. What's happening?
This kid's pissing me off today. I'm going to go with
I'm
that
I'm just going to go with Heaven Tonight and fuck you, In Color. And the first two Cars albums for that matter.
Yeah, you speak highly of those guys too.
Yeah.
Oh yeah,
and again, like, you know, I don't give a shit about. I don't care about Shake It Up or Heartbeat City. That's when everybody else got on the bandwagon. Shake It Up, Heartbeat City, the beginnings of MTV. I did not like that stuff at all, man. They lost me after Panorama.
Cars are very similar to Cheap Trick. They've really got like three records we love, and then after that, it drops off.
Same thing. Cars is a similar situation, yeah. Except the Cars, obviously, after Door to Door, they just stopped.
Do you feel that way about Van Halen? Like 1984 was like that, you know, obviously a huge breakout record for them, and it was videos. There were videos all over the place. I think they did well with the video era. Because Dave really sold it.
Oh, my God. Dave was MTV for a little while.
He definitely was. It was his image. Even his first solo record was just...
It was the biggest, practically the biggest star in the world at one point. It felt like it.
I mean, obviously, there's better Van Halen records than before.
Yeah, I think Van Halen did better with the videos, and so did David Lee Roth after David Lee Roth left Van Halen. Because in the early years of MTV, Van Halen was kind of invisible. Yep. Because they didn't really make concept videos. The only thing you saw of Van Halen was from like a concert. Like you saw So This Is Love.
They had a couple of concept. They had I think one for Unchained.
Unchained was a live clip.
I remember the live clip though.
And maybe So This Is Love.
And then they had like Pretty Woman, which got banned, so we never saw it.
Right, yeah. But that made you want to see it more.
Yeah, it's like the first real video that Van Halen that I remember seeing was Jump.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
It looked like it was seen it from F Troop or something, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And
there's really not much footage of Van Halen from like their first three or four albums. You don't see that much from them, even in the archives. I mean, if there are Van Halen archives,
of course there are.
I'm sure there are.
What's that shit?
You know, why are they not going into? You know, Eddie Trunk talks about this all the time, man. For 40 years. What the fuck have they done? Like, what are they doing? Why are they not going into the vaults? If they're not going to release new stuff in 30 years, at least go into the vaults, man.
They're not like money. Why not do it?
For this? There's a demand for this. There was a Van Halen fan
base.
Maybe
those bands weren't doing it. I mean, you know, Prince did it. Obviously, Prince got a vault full of shit. Michael Jackson was another guy who's got supposedly a vault full of stuff that was unreleased and recorded.
Yeah.
Obviously, John Lennon did, because when they released the number ones or that anthology, they took a cassette recording of John and the three remaining Beatles, recorded with it, with what's his name, as produced it. He produced it.
Jeff Lynne.
Was it Free as a Bird?
Was it you? I was talking about that drum sound, Jeff Lynne drum sound.
Yeah, you hear it in Tom Petty, Traveling Wilburys, fucking later Beatles
and
stuff.
I hate to say it, but it's become dated now.
It is, yeah. But that's that sound.
So I guess we're supposed to be talking about disco. I feel bad for anybody that's just like caught on to the show and just kind of discovered us through our disco episode. And it's like, okay, part two of the disco episode. And now they're like sitting here talking about Cheap Trick and the Cars.
Yeah, we got to warm up a little bit.
Hey, listen.
It's called the What's
Going On
segment.
We just want to welcome anybody that's new to the podcast. We are a rock and roll podcast, and we kind of look at rock and roll over the last all seven decades of rock and roll. We kind of ask the question, what is rock and roll's place in the 21st century? And we, you know, debate, argue, fist fight, everything else in between over different, you know, various topics on rock and roll. Sometimes we have guests, and sometimes it's just us to defend for ourselves.
Big shout out to California, man. We're getting a lot of people from California listening to the show.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
I love the left coast, too. Mm. Did we talk about the Defiant Ones on HBO?
We talked. The documentary? You told me about it at the bar the other night. Couple weeks. Well,
anybody and everybody.
My sense of time is kind of distorted right now.
It's a series about Jimmy Iovine and Dr. Dre, and it is amazing. Every single episode, all four of them are unreal. Unreal.
It's a documentary.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And by the way, he liked our. I said, you know, hey, it was a great job or whatever to the producer, and he liked our.
Jimmy
tweet.
Iovine?
No. Alan Hughes, I think his name is. Okay. I have to look at it. But he liked our. He liked what we had to say, you know, on Twitter. I was like, that's cool. He was up. But, it touches Iovine from just being an engineer.
Right.
From producing the Springsteen records. To bring in Because of the Night to Patti Smith. To bring in Stop Dragging My Heart Around to Stevie Nicks. Because he was sleeping with Stevie Nicks. And it flips.
Status.
It flip-flops. It does some Jimmy Iovine stuff. It does some Dr. Dre stuff. And NWA. And that whole West Coast rap thing. And Suge Knight. And Death Row Records, and I'm not going to go crazy about it, but watch it. Trust me, watch it.
Is Jimmy Iovine?
I was always wondering what that was, but you kind of spelled it out a little bit better.
Is he the guy from Standing in Line with Mr. Jimmy? can't always get what you want.
I don't know that Iovine was around that early,
that
man.
Early?
No, Iovine was Jimmy Iovine was more mid-70s. He produced Easter, and he was with in the studio with Bruce when he was recording Darkness. I don't think he has a credit. Does he have a producing credit? I don't think he
might have just been an engineer.
I think he was just an engineer, but you know he's. He comes into the picture with Patti Smith because he's the one. He was the middle person between Bruce and Patti when it comes to giving the night to Patti. He's the one that gave her the tape.
He wasn't a junkie, as far as you know, was he?
No,
I don't know about that.
U2, he's produced. I mean, the guy is. Yeah. I think he's talking about. I thought the Stones were talking about Jimi Hendrix. He was standing in line.
No, it was definitely a guy who produced their records, man. I think his name is probably
I could be wrong, man. I could be wrong. It could be him, but I
don't know. On that record and see.
I would think he'd be like too young at the time. I don't know.
I'm going to get up at one point.
We'll get back to that.
Yeah. If anybody does know that, shoot us a message.
Yeah, that's some good trivia. I thought it was always Hendrix.
We were polling the audience on Facebook, asking for people's various experiences with disco if you were around in the 70s. And we got. I don't know. Did we get anything? That's right. I did. I'm total brain fart.
We definitely got some hits on it. People were talking about it. I even chimed feedback. In a little bit.
Yeah, I'm lost here. Help me out here, man. Somebody say something.
What are you lost about?
No. On this Facebook thing. What question did you ask?
Just like, what was your experience with disco? How do you remember? What do you remember about disco as if you were a rock fan? Mm-hmm. I want to hear from the people that were rock fans in the 70s that kind of just like what we're doing tonight and just talking about our own memories of disco.
Right. The first one right off the bat, the guy said, Comiskey Park. I mean, that's obvious. Everybody's slamming disco at Comiskey Park.
Right.
And I agreed with one of the people that posted on it, and I love it because, I mean, you had some solid bass grooves, and it just kind of led to a whole nother level. Mm-hmm. Some of those rock guys learned off of listening to those, future rock guys learned off of listening to those records.
Absolutely.
And got some can you imagine Flea just listening to a 2/4? He's, he was boom, boom, bam, boom, boom.
Oh, that was Larry, man. That was Larry. He's a friend of ours. The songs are so bass driven. I've grown to appreciate it as I've grown older. That's the consensus, man. Is like, we pretended to hate it back then because it was the cool thing to do.
I never pretended to hate it. I was a fan.
It has grown more credible with time.
I mean, and it's the backbone to hip hop. A guy like Dr. Dre takes some of those funk and old disco records, mm-hmm. and that's the basis of what he puts his production on it, and then he gets somebody like Snoop Dogg to come in and lay down some vocals on it, and it just is fucking insane. Parliament Funkadelic records, and it's so good.
It's aged well, man.
It has.
It
definitely has.
And, okay. That's the most interesting thing about the whole phenomenon is why did the rock people find it so threatening to take it so far as to have disco record, burning ceremonies, the disco suck ceremonies, everything they're doing. Why was it that much of a threat? I certainly remember
Little Dick Syndrome.
Little Dick Syndrome, right?
Or flamboyance. Yeah.
I think you just said it, bro.
Some of those guys, a lot of the gay crowd was listening to that stuff, and maybe they felt threatened by that. I don't know. I mean, because people were just showing themselves at that point, and not afraid anymore.
A twinge of homophobia might have something to do with that, too. Think about that, but you're right, man.
Yeah, and the thing I just got done with, there's a lot of discussion about that, where it's just like the racial and sexual and gender overtones and implications that went with disco was not at all lost on the rock-centric mind, and it was just a lot of Little Dick Syndrome, I think.
Yeah,
A lot of rock.
It's supposed to look like this, and we're macho, and rockers don't look like this, and rockers don't do that. And, we drink Jack Daniels and, carry shotguns in the back of our pickup trucks, that type of thing.
But, so superficial the differences, man. All right, so they had CBGBs, they had Studio 54. They both wore a uniform of sorts, Disco, you dressed like the Village People if you want it. Disco, dressed like the Village People. Rockers wear your leather jacket and blue jeans. They're all on drugs, man, Everybody in Studio 54 was doing coke. All the CBGB crowd was totally whacked. They both had music that they gathered around in a tribal sense. They just had they were really doing the same thing with a different mask. Doing the same two sides of the same coin. Same thing.
It's Studio 54 in particular. I mean, how can you not talk about that? It's, you know, that changed the, that forever changed the nightlife in New York City.
I would have loved to have gotten in, man.
I wonder if anyone got in.
Did anyone get into both? I want to talk to a person that got into both. And not because of connections.
What is the other? 54 and what? 54
and CBGBs.
And CBGBs. I could picture somebody like Blondie.
Lot, man. Yeah.
I'm not saying because you're stacking
or Warhol.
Of course, celebrities. Oh, like the guy in the
normal,
street that
average
did
it. Right,
schlub like us. Yeah. Right, right, right. I could have. I guess I could have. I mean, it was hard to get into 3 or 4. When they peaked, it was very difficult to get into that club. Very difficult. Especially because it was everybody, you know, the Who's Who was in that joint at that night, and you weren't going to get picked. Maybe they picked, I don't know, maybe what they picked? Maybe 30 people out of the whole
beautiful
crowd
people, man.
Yeah, exactly.
Very hard to get in. But I don't know. Did rock fans think that disco was going to threaten the existence of air music?
It did. I think it did for a while.
It definitely dominated when the charts.
You know, there's kind of two. I've learned that. To almost divide it into, there's almost like this invisible dividing line, and I don't know quite where it happens. So I'll use Saturday Night Fever as that dividing line, where there's the whole beginnings of disco, where disco isn't really disco. They don't quite know what the hell it is, and it kind of goes back to the late '60s, and where you have
that. that's what that was. Sorry, man. Didn't mean to do it in your face.
God damn, Cheech and Chong.
You were saying?
I don't remember what I was saying.
I thought you were looking right at me.
Yeah, I thought so too. I did not see that. I
don't know. Oh man!
But so. you had this sense of R&B and soul, kind of, and Philly soul, where you had you know, with like the stylistics that whole thing in the early '70s, and
but you've always had that in rock and roll. I mean, early rock and roll was always taken from R&B and you know, it's the Motown and stuff like that. They were always jacking off those, you know, that sounded weird. They were always stealing from those folks. They weren't jacking off.
No, of course. I mean, we were. Yeah. I mean, the rockers were always stealing too from blues artists.
Yeah.
But where you had, you know, like, let's just like say it for what it is. It's all black music.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
Where you had Motown, and then it kind of, where you get into the early '70s, a lot of black music was getting, it was very dark. It was very like, you know, you had like a lot, like social, it just kind of reflected social turmoil, you know, like Marvin
Gaye. What's going on? Is that
what
you're doing?
Exactly. What's going on? Living for the City, Inner City Blues, Backstabbers, you know, the OJs.
Yeah.
There was just a lot of, it was almost like they got tired of it, man, and they just wanted like a sweeter sound, and then it became all about love and then all about sex eventually, and they just kind of the conversation I had a few weeks ago in part one of this kind of pinpoints Barry White as that person that kind of brought like the first real disco hit was the Love Theme by Barry White, which was like that
all strings
instrumental.
Yeah.
He brought strings into it and all these like more sophisticated arrangements, which kind of stuff that, you know, Nile Rodgers could really take and really let blossom, man, in ways that, you know,
good enough for your
that wasn't happening in 1971 or 1970. You know, Edwin Starr wore all that dark stuff that was happening.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and then again, it's identified primarily with the black and gay listener, you know, and it goes back to like those clubs, the first gay clubs, man, like the
Stonewall.
It was
given a voice. It was given, you know, they were homosexuals especially. Yeah. I mean, they were just hiding out in the shadows. They were there. It's nothing new. It didn't happen overnight.
It
it's been
really
happening since fucking
first,
ancient Rome and Greece.
Oh, my God.
You know, it was the first openly gay bar in New York City where gay people could dance, mm-hmm. you know, and then you'd have the cops busting in and raiding the place and taking $2,000 a week.
Kind of reminds
to
you of the
tip
old,
them off when the raids are going to happen.
Kind of reminds you of the old Cotton Club back in the day, right? Yeah. Cops would come kicking in the door and bring, all right, all you black people, blah, blah, blah.
Okay. Extortion.
Yeah, exactly what it was.
Yeah, but in like the 60s, it was almost like, you know, they're going down the line of social change, okay? Like, you know, we got, like, black people got civil rights legislation passed in 1964.
Let's
so let's go
group.
Now fuck with the gays.
Yeah, let's
man.
Go fuck with another group now. Exactly right. Yeah, I agree.
And that's what happened.
I agree 100% on
that. And, you know, it was played in the clubs in the early 70s, and even radio kind of shunned it. They kind of looked down on it, and then kind of, hey, they were playing it in the clubs, so they were buying it.
Yeah.
And it was kind of like, who the hell is buying this music?
Not only
now they
that,
had no choice, but the radios had no choice but to play it.
Not only that, but if you had a hot DJ in the club that night, and I mean, he would press his night.
DJs became
and sell that
the DJs. Celebrities.
Yeah, and that you know, and paved the way for like that 80s music.
Where but, it started.
You know, I mean, his night was recorded and pressed on vinyl and sold. Or better than that, it was released like underground. You know, you could get the oh, this was like July 19th at Studio 54, DJ Pat was there, and boom, you know? I don't know, man. I just, when I was DJing, I worked primarily, it was primarily a rock club, but when I had some people there that really wanted to hear club and disco and stuff, there was nothing better in the world than having that one headphone on your shoulder, and you're queuing up two records, man, and you're just trying to get that beat, and you're bopping up the beats per minute, and then you finally get it, and you're like, yeah, that's it. And then you're fading one out and fading one in.
Ooh.
Nothing like it in the world, man. Wow. I got goosebumps on my arms thinking about it. There's nothing like it in the whole world.
Thumping your chest like a silverback gorilla.
Yeah, man. People just started moving, you know, and people moved, and they felt it. And they're like, this guy's on his game right now, man. And
you were doing that, obviously. You were using turntables, man.
Yeah,
I was using turntables. It wasn't just like all digital now, where you can just like put like two tracks together and
you could
just
do it
mix
with CDs, though. I mean, the technology's there to do it with CDs now.
Well, yeah.
But I had a.
But you were the real deal, man.
Yeah, I had turntables. Two turntables and a microphone. But, you know, like mixing. I don't know. It's been 30 years, so I can't even remember some of the shit that I was mixing. But there was just nothing like it in the world when you finally got that groove and you knew you were in and it was locked in. And then you. The test was because to learn to do it, it had to be like a dead night. And I can remember the first one that I tried. My boss looked up at me. He was like, "No, that didn't happen."
Yeah,
you know, it was just wonky, and just and I knew it.
Misfired.
Yeah,
it happens.
But when it locked in, and it was just like, boom, the test was fading out and fading, you know, fading another one up. And you're like, yeah, okay, there it is.
So I don't think there's any doubt then, man, that a lot of the bad feelings about disco from the rock crowd came from some homophobia. Based on what we've discussed,
and,
man.
And prejudice.
And fear and prejudice. That was no doubt part of it. When we get to
the
hysteria, that's what we're getting. That's there.
And it's like anything. If especially politicians and cops and your uptight white guy, if they don't know it, they fear it. That's their first reaction is fear of it. You know, a guy with his horn-rimmed glasses on in the 70s and his uptight fucking jacket, his dinner jacket, he walks by Studio 54. He's like, oh, my God, what the fuck is that, honey? Let's move it. Come on, move it.
Yep, you know what?
Move it along.
It's a lot sharper than... A lot sharper than...
He walks so tight his ass can shoot out, you know, diamonds.
Beth Ann Hardison, the model, is I think she's credited with the quote that the disco beat was created so that white people can dance.
Hell yeah!
I'd agree with that only on the sense that with that dividing line where it became like... Where the white people caught on to it with Saturday Night Fever because it was this underground thing that was happening.
Very true.
And Saturday Night Fever comes out at the end of 77 and brings it into everybody's living room. It brings it into mainstream America by 78. And now everybody's fucking listening to disco. Everybody's making disco. Even the rock artists are making disco songs. And white people are listening to it. And white people are trying to get into 54.
Thank you.
And white people are running 54.
Thank you to the Italians.
You know what? We're drawing the race card a lot tonight, but accurately
but you know what?
Man.
It is what it is.
White people caught on.
It is what it is.
Yeah.
We are three white people talking about disco, man. And somebody's going to be sitting there saying, hey, what do these white boys know about disco?
John Travolta showed us the light. You know, he showed Whitey.
No, but.
He provided the blueprint.
I have to. I kind of acknowledged the last time that. When you have trends catch on in the mainstream, man, when things break, it kind of opens it up to bastardization, and it opens it up to overexposure, and it opens it up to being
disco duck, man.
Yeah, the end of something, whereas if it's beginning for a lot more people, you know what I mean? It's beginning for the mainstream, but the people that just kind of enjoyed it and created it in its purest form are saying, fuck, we lost it to the world. You know,
that's when they moved on. That's when they moved on to hip-hop.
It's inevitable. Yeah. It's inevitable. Yeah.
That's when they moved on. That early or late 70s, early 80s, that's when they were like, okay, we got these turntables. We're mixing music. Let's start. And it just took off from there. That's how I look at it. You're right.
It
that trend had already begun. You know, the volume of people that were into it at that point.
Right.
It just wasn't working out for the historians anymore.
You're like, no, it's not.
Let's move on.
They didn't like dinosaurs.
The trendsetters, if you will.
But contrary to what was said earlier, man, people really weren't buying disco albums in droves. The albums, Donna Summer maybe and the Bee Gees, but they didn't
not
sell.
Until later, yeah.
And in concerts, they didn't really play too many concerts either, really. It seemed to do very well for clubs, club life.
It was a club thing.
It was a club thing. These artists were not attracting huge crowds or selling a lot of records, I don't think. The record industry was even in some turmoil from 78 to 80.
They were putting out singles, more or less.
Yeah.
And extended like a 12-inch version of a song that would just run and run. Uh-huh. Like,
yeah.
So you could get that beat to mix it down with something else. But that being said, the point you just made, it was great. But that being said, the
record industry being in turmoil.
I just lost it. I lost it because you had such a great point. I was just jumping on your coattails with
but
it.
But that definitely was the case, man.
You'll get
with
it,
the record industry, like just like losing a lot of money, especially like Casablanca.
Uh-huh.
Who, when Casablanca, you know, I mean, look, obviously
home of Kiss and Donna Summer.
Artists. Yeah. Being Kiss, but let's brush them aside for a second because they had Donna Summer, and Donna Summer was their, you know, she was the one that, I mean, they released four double albums in a row. She released four consecutive
double
albums.
Four double in a row? That's pretty nuts.
Okay.
That's a lot of music.
You had, that's a nutty fact.
Yeah, you had Once Upon a Time.
Live and I always see.
Live and More, which is always around.
Always see that.
Bad Girls and On the Radio. So between that and the failure of the Kiss solo albums, man, Casablanca just, they fucking tanked.
What was the rationale behind making them all double albums?
It's like the 70s, that'd be the answer to anything else in the 70s, man. Excess. It was the Roman Empire, man. Just total fucking excess.
It's contrary to
just
business sense, though.
Everything.
The
man.
Reason you and I didn't get Kiss Alive right away is because it was a double album. That cost Ma, I don't know, $12.99 instead of $6.99. We didn't get those albums. They don't sell.
All these songs are on the other albums, too.
I don't get Kiss Alive. Look at the size of that. Get hot in hell.
You're
going to
get
up.
The Gene Simmons record or
well,
you're going to get the Ace Frehley
record? Simultaneous,
not getting double platinum.
You had simultaneous success of Kiss Alive and Love to Love You Baby by Donna Summer. And you had this Casablanca just, it went to their head. First off,
well, the coke went to
between that and, and, you know, so it was
those
Donna Summer.
Record executives are doing just as much coke as the people.
Kiss, the Village People later on, a couple years later. So they were at the top of the whole disco scene, you know. I mean, you could say, well, 1978, RSO owned the charts with the Bee Gees later on. But prior to that, they were not selling records, man.
But they were making movies.
It was a club thing.
They were making movies about the clubs. They were showing people
what's
going on.
Yeah, even 78 was the year of Thank God It's Friday. In fact, that was kind of the one that
Foxes.
Really made...
Like on the radio was in Foxes with Sherry Curry. We got a vinyl record.
We have a vinyl record here in my hand.
Four
Stick Nixon
vinyl
brought,
albums in one.
Stick Nixon brought the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack, and he bought this. What is this? KTEL, as seen on television. Is this one of those KTEL things?
Look at the label,
it's
bro. Called, you're smarter than me when it comes
it's
to
it's called A Night at Studio 54, and the label is Studio 54. And this was put out by Casablanca.
Was it?
A double album.
Doesn't have the Casablanca label.
No, it's basically a custom label with the 54
It's probably under
logo.
The Casablanca album, like umbrella or something.
And
you
had
Chic. Productions.
It's funny because Chic is the first song on here. And this is, Nile Rodgers obviously wrote that because
my
they did
favorite,
not get into
mine is
favorite.
Mine and Stick's favorite disco song of all time is on that album. I want to see if it's the same.
Mine's kind of corny, man.
Mine's GQ, Disco Nights.
Mine is I Love the Nightlife. By the Nightlife.
That GQ Disco Nights, when I hear that opening. And I like. I also like the Crusader Street Life. That's not on that album.
Yeah, I like that.
I don't know if I have a favorite disco song.
I have a couple songs I'd like to hit you with, man. Just a couple, man. Isn't the greatest one of all really Dancing Queen by ABBA? Isn't that the greatest one? Dancing Queen, guys. That's the apex to me, almost.
But I never did
ABBA. No.
I never did ABBA.
Nah.
All right, we shot one
that's
down.
That's just white people.
Fuck you guys.
That's white people hopping on the bandwagon.
Yeah, that's the white people
it's just
bandwagon.
Like Swedish white people with blonde hair.
You can't get any whiter than that.
Shit on everything. Hopping on the bandwagon. I mean, look, Dancing Queen, right. I love
they
ABBA, man.
They have white on their white.
People out there on the internet, support me.
Platinum blonde
that didn't
hair.
Start too well, but real quickly, that other song, To Be Real.
To Be Real. That's a good one.
That's pretty awesome.
That's a very good one.
We Are Family.
Is that Sister Sledge?
Reminds me of 1979 Pittsburgh
that was like
Pirates.
That was like right before disco was officially declared dead.
You're right. Yes, that was
that
the
came late.
Pittsburgh Pirates.
Pittsburgh Pirates.
Reminds me of that. I got all caught up in that World Series.
We named a lot of Cincinnati Reds last time. Let's go down to the 1979 Pirates, man. You had Omar Marino. Mm. You had John Candelaria. You had Willie Stargell. You had Dave Parker. You had who the fuck else?
Kent Tekulve.
Kent Tekulve. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, boy, it was hard to hit a ball out of that stadium, too, man.
That was a fun team to watch, man. The crowd jumping up and down. We Are Family down 3-1.
Yeah.
And they came back.
Who else was on
that
team?
Who else was on that team? Chuck Tanner was the coach. Chuck Tanner.
Chuck Tanner. That reminds me of Tanner from the Bad News Bears.
Oh, shit.
What else?
Who was another guy? Dale Barra.
Was that?
Dale Barra.
Dale Barra, man.
Yogi's
yeah.
kid, that's right. Yeah. He notoriously had the baseball card. With his bat like this, holding it like this, and it said "fuck you" on the knob.
Did it?
Yeah, you can. They very limited run of those cards got out, and you can find it.
Oh man,
that's an awesome card, man.
Yeah, it says right on the knob there, "fuck you."
Wow. Yeah, Dave Parker, Willie Stargell coming to bat. Watch
Stargell
out.
Was something else to watch, boy.
Yeah.
And Pittsburgh's version of Dave Winfield.
I love the tacky colors too.
Who is their
the
catcher?
Bright yellow.
Ed Ott.
Yeah, yellow
Ott.
Black. Yeah. Anything else on that list there?
Right, so that list, not much worth talking about.
Okay.
So wait.
The Hustle.
The Hustle.
Do the Hustle.
Like I said, mine was Disco Nights. It's
Van McCoy.
Crusaders.
Disco Duck.
Disco Duck.
I liked Maxine Nightingale, man. Do it. Right, get right back to where we started from.
Get right, right back. Start it from.
What else?
I never thought of that as disco so much. But
no, but it was kind of right in that. I also like
that feels like Captain and Tennille to me.
Gloria Gaynor, not the one that you were singing, the one that her, like her first, I guess it was her first big hit, which was, I think, I'm pretty sure it was Gloria Gaynor. She remade a Jackson song, Jackson 5. I used it in our trailer, man. I used it in our trailer when I put together the disco.
Dancing Machine. No, it wasn't Dancing Machine.
Well, I'll think of it as the
show. It's amazing that
on.
The Jacksons were God still around then, too, because Dancing Machine was a huge hit for them then. And he was out there doing the robot before everybody else.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about him, he would go to Studio 54, and they said the reason why he was always so current with his dancing was that he was always watching those people underground, basically,
right.
clubs,
oh,
watching
yeah.
what they
watching.
Were doing, and then mm-hmm. taking that and learning from
learning
it.
From the best.
And then doing notes. It, you know, and bringing it out to the masses.
Way to do it. Way to do it.
Yeah.
I love the Off the Wall record. I love. I think it's one of my favorite albums of that era. I mean, it's a
is that Michael?
Later. Yeah, that's Mike. That's Mike.
Does that have?
I think it's better. I think it's a better album.
And you don't
than
stop. On it.
I don't think it's better than Thriller.
No.
Yeah, it does have Don't Stop Too.
Yeah,
that's I do not think it's better. I think he's peaked at Thriller. Obviously, yeah, was, yeah. I think that's the where you know it's kind of where I stop. But it's a better disco. It's a better disco record. There's a really cool documentary about that record too, with Quincy Jones talking about it and how they got each song and who wrote what. Spike Lee has gotten a hold of a lot of the archives. And,
I think Michael
Jackson
is one of those artists like Donna Summer and David Bowie and the Beatles who needed the producer. He needed the right producer holding his hand and that those artists would not have been the same without that right producer.
You know,
so if you take like Brian Eno away from David Bowie, or if you take Tony Visconti away from Bowie, or if you take George Martin away from the Beatles, or if you take Giorgio Moroder away from Donna Summer, take Quincy Jones away from Michael Jackson, man.
But everything that's always been said is that the guy went in knowing what he wanted to do, and Quincy was more or less just a button pusher.
Yeah, I just don't think he was ever as good as when he had Quincy with him. I don't know. You
kind of said they held
but
the artist.
Quincy made all those fucking albums anyway, man. He did Thriller. Did he do Off the Wall? Yeah. He did Off the Wall. He did Bad, I think.
I don't know if he did Bad. He might have. I don't know.
I think, like I said,
Thriller kind of, it was his peak.
Well, those artists did good shit without him, too, Bowie did plenty of awesome shit without him.
Well, yeah, I think Bowie's three people that he needed was Tony Visconti, was obviously Mick Ronson, Brian Eno, and Tony Visconti.
Really good call, Stick.
It's for each era of Bowie that was important, there was somebody behind that.
That's another one who was in that disco scene and thrived off of it. He was like taking pieces of that and applying it to what he would soon be, what he would become later.
Yeah.
And, he saw changes and was like, okay, we're going through this now. Let's try this. Let's do that. And, and when he synced up with a producer like Niall, especially, and he synced up with a guy like Niall, and they were listening.
It was almost like his commercial peak, right?
Yeah. And they were listening to things together, and they're like, hey, remember this? Let's look at this. And, obviously it was later than the 70s.
I forgot
at that point.
He did that. I think you pointed that out to me, man.
What?
That Niall was behind that record.
Yeah. Right.
Almost like the big trivia question around Let's Dance is
Stevie Ray.
Right. And you forget about the other credits, man.
Niall with the I think Niall actually came up with the riff.
Yeah.
Because
the gripes about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, man, I'm glad they got it right this year and at least acknowledged Nile Rodgers, even if it was a special award of recognition, I mean?
Yeah.
Because he is a giant that does not get enough positive attention. Any attention.
Him coming back with
I don't know any negative attention, but, he just deserves more attention.
He had a smash hit 2 years ago with those robot guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Smash hit.
Yeah.
You know? You know what? We haven't talked about the bands that went disco. There's only a couple when I think about it. The two obvious ones. Rock and Roll bands that jumped on a bandwagon.
A lot of them, man.
I would say Kiss and the Stones are the first two to come to mind.
Those are the two big ones, Kiss and the Stones. Rod Stewart. After that, help me. Who else?
Heart.
Okay.
The Grateful Dead, Shakedown Street.
Shakedown Street.
Sure. Pink Floyd, Another Brick in the Wall.
Yeah. I can agree with that one. See, before the whole record wasn't really kind of like that. It was just one song.
That's the big misconception. Blondes Have More Fun is Rod Stewart's disco album.
It's not
a disco album. Dynasty is not Kiss's disco album. Yeah.
Same is true for the Dead.
Shakedown Street is not a disco album, man. But they all took that beat and they kind of made something around it.
They made disco songs. That brought us out. It was Made for Loving You. Thank you. Disco,
and
I love
there
that
was
song.
Rock influence in disco too, because you had where, again, I mentioned Giorgio Moroder. I mentioned him a whole bunch in the last episode, man. To the point where I just almost wanted to edit it out. But that Donna Summer, like I Feel Love, that fucking repetitive thing that goes on for six fucking hours. Man.
Welcome to the club.
And the Chase, which was they used to use it on This Week in Baseball all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But you can mix to that.
Around 79, Donna Summer gets fucking electric guitar into the mix in Hot Stuff and the Bad Girls album, man. Right. You start hearing rock influence in disco and not just disco influence in rock.
Right. Well, cross-pollination going on.
Exactly. So 79 is a weird year because it's a year where they say disco broke in 77. All right, I'll fucking buy that, man.
Same year, punk supposedly broke.
It was already kind of after the fact. But everybody was fucking doing it. There's more disco in 79 than there was in 77.
Yeah.
In 78 or 70, there was...
Because like you said, it takes a little while for people
to catch
on. And
there was more disco in 76 than there was in 77. So good figure. When did it really break on the mainstream charts? But 79 was the year where it just fucking bottomed out. It just kind of hits a peak.
Right.
Everything comes to a head, rock and disco.
Mm-hmm.
Steve Dahl blows up all those records in Comiskey Park.
Right.
2 weeks later, they declare disco dead when My Sharona hits number one and knocks out I think is I Will Survive, or one of those songs knocks it off the number of the Billboard charts, or knocks it off the number one position. And my conversation with Alice Eccles a few weeks ago, we kind of touched a little bit on that, but we can't really pinpoint why, or it just was something that it came to a point where it was just too much of everything. There were too many people. There was too much product out there.
Too many men.
Too many people jumping on the bandwagon.
Products. Saturate the market.
Exactly, man. When something gets that big, it has to die.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it's Harry Carey.
You got to kill it.
Absolutely, man. So I don't know. I really liked the way the Stones and Kiss handled disco. I like that stuff a lot.
And by Stones, we're thinking the same song, obviously, Emotional Rescue.
That record.
Yeah, that would be in there. Miss You.
It's a good call. Yeah.
Hot
good
stuff. Call. But the Stones were flirting with disco early on Goat's Head Soup a little bit. Dancing with Mr. D.
Yes, and that is disco.
Fingerprint File.
No doubt. They are experienced.
And some
of the
sounds that come out of Mick's voice at the end of Fingerprint File, man, kind of precede Michael Jackson in the 80s.
Fantastic.
I dare say that. You know what I'm talking about? Like that high-pitched thing that Michael Jackson does that he kind of started doing. He didn't really do until... Listen to Fingerprint File, man.
Yeah.
That came out in 1974.
Listen to Fingerprint File of Michael Jackson.
It's kind of like, you know, who invented the devil horns? Is it really Dio, or was it really Gene Simmons? Who did it first? There's no record of...
Ozzy might have done it before.
There's no picture
of
Gene Simmons before 1977. Yeah.
People doing that at least friggin' the 18th century.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's a threat to rock and roll fans too. They see their favorite bands going disco. It's infiltrating the very shit they love, even the Deadheads. So maybe some of them found it threatening on that level too.
I don't know.
It's true. Their heroes are doing it at that point, right? Yeah.
I don't know if like Deadheads thought about it that way, man. I don't know.
Because it was the vibe of the shows.
When we do our Dead episode, it'd be an interesting question to ask some of our older Deadhead friends. What was their thoughts when Shakedown Street came out? Did they think, oh, the Dead are doing disco? Or it was this is great.
We're still rocking the fuck out over here. Yeah.
We still love it.
Yeah. You know? So God knows Kiss was much more successful in co-opting disco than they were some years later when they tried to go grunge. That went badly. Kiss's disco work was much more convincing than their grunge work.
It's a good song.
Kiss was shameless, though, and
it's
trying to...
It's a fucking good song, man. I Was Made for Loving You. It's a fucking good song. Yeah. When I still hear it, I'm like, fuck, that's a good tune.
It is a good tune. I'm glad you said
They should have just kept Vinnie Poncia and had him keep making their albums through the 80s,
man. That's fucking awesome, man.
It's sexy.
Tonight.
I want to shoot it on your face. Same. You're gonna fall.
He probably did, didn't he?
Gonna, bitch.
The disco years.
So is that all we got, man? Unless you want to put this one to rest.
I wasn't that threatened by disco, honestly, growing up, man. You know, I put on a macho face saying, yeah, disco sucks, but I don't think I really cared.
I think the three of us might have been a little too young to be threatened by it. I think that says a lot for us to like it like we do.
It wasn't cool.
We didn't like
to
it till,
like
I didn't like
disco,
it till later,
no,
though.
We
life.
Were not, we like, we, none of I us, we, I don't kid. Know, I didn't know you when we were kids.
True.
But I only know, like, I knew him, and it was kind of like,
me.
You know, you would never admit to liking disco back then. You know, we were Kiss fans, we were rock fans.
The surroundings where I grew up, it wasn't all rock fans. Like, you know, it was accepted.
You know,
it was definitely accepted.
But we loved what we loved, man, and there was so much good rock music out there that I don't think that rock fans as a whole were all that bothered by disco. I think it was just, again... you nailed it, man. The homophobia, the racism and the homophobia out there that kind of put that ugly face on rock fans.
Yeah.
And kind of...
drove a wedge between people,
it,
too.
It really did. Yeah, I don't think it was a majority,
a
man.
Coming down the road, you're like, well, fuck this and, you know, it's...
Yeah, it really did. Yeah. It's like in the 80s, calling them Guidos. Remember the Guidos?
There was a post about feeling sorry about for the rock fans between 75 or 76 and 78, 79 or whatever. And it was like... Look, it was such a terrible time, man. We had Led Zeppelin. You could still go see Led Zeppelin live, man. Pink Floyd put out this horrible new album called Animals, you know? There were all these horrible fucking new bands like Cheap Trick and the Cars and Van Halen and the Clash and the Ramones, man. What a horrible time to be a rock fan, you know? What I feel sorry for, man, are the rock fans today, that are the young rock fans today who don't have Jack Fuck for rock and roll, you know?
No, Jack Fuck is definitely not playing. I haven't seen his name anywhere. So, I don't know. I'm just nitpicking.
We'll find it. It's Thermate. Like I said, man, I'm still listening to that Thermate record. Six songs.
That's the band I forgot to plug on the last description. I'm gonna have to tag them.
Oh, to tag Thermate, yeah.
Who are they?
Thermate. I'll play some of it for
usually
you.
Is the number eight in there? No, it's no. Thermate, like the thermos, like...
Thermate, I think, is a
therm, like temperature. Therm.
No, there was. I thought it was like a mineral, maybe, or something like that. I thought I looked it up. Yeah. I'll off air, we'll talk about it because I might play a little. Actually, you could probably put it on your YouTube.
Yeah.
But it's good, man. Sounds very. It sounds old, so I mean that's probably why I dig it.
Yeah.
But it's good. I like it a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's all I got about disco, man.
Yeah, and the final analysis, disco gets the stamp of approval from all three of the Rock and the Fire members.
The job is yours.
Pouring on me, bad news keep pouring on me, bad news.